A warm Christian greeting to each one who has gathered out to worship and fellowship this evening. A few things before we get started this evening. I should share with you, while I was eating supper at Brother Henry's place, I got a call from my wife who said that she had just gotten word from Verlin, my son-in-law, that Violet's heart is now beating on its own. So that's good news. I called Violet this morning just to talk with her. If you're ever a father, you'll understand. And she told me this morning, she says, Verlin, I think Verlin is more concerned about this than I am. And I guess if you're a husband, you understand. So I don't think Violet is woken up yet. She's not recovered, so maybe I can give you some more update tomorrow night. But I do have a family picture here. Jolene knows who she is. But if you'd like to see who she is, maybe I can post it on the bulletin board back here, or you come and see me about that. Are you still remembering the number that you gave yourself last night as a result of the quiz? Don't tell me. Just keep that in your mind. The number that you got in terms of your quiz. Now, another thing. Brother Norman just got done telling us some profound things. We can go home right now and think about the profound things that he told us. And we could enlarge on that, but we won't right now. Did you know that half of what you will ever learn in all of your life that we have learned by age 2? Now you might wonder how that can be. But when you think about what is completely or almost completely, unborn babies already know some things. But the amount of learning that it takes to walk and the amount of learning that it takes to talk is just enormous. Now, he said his son comes home from work and says, I learned 2 things or 3 things. Well, every day, babies and little children are learning maybe 150 things per day. We are very complex people. We just recently had Sumner Loomis at our church and school to talk to us. He told us some very, very important things. I better not get started on that one. Better just leave that. Let me share something that I just learned that I'd like to share with you. Our brother was reading from John 13 tonight. And we read that passage and we think certain things about Jesus. But in our Sunday school, this past Sunday at Rosewood, we were studying from Isaiah 49. And I would like to share something that I learned from this. You know, we know that Jesus taught us to wash feet, and we say, yes, he's our master, and we need to be obedient to him like that. And we understand he is God. He has the right to tell us things like that. But, you know, the New Testament does not say everything that Jesus thought and said. So if you'd like to see something very interesting, turn to Isaiah 49. And I'd like to show you some things that this prophecy says as to how Jesus felt. This is clear that this is referring to Jesus. I'll start reading in verse 3. And he said to me, I think that he is referring to God. And the me is Jesus. He says, you are my servant, O Israel, in whom I will be glorified. Then I said, or Jesus said, I have labored in vain. I have spent my strength for nothing and in vain. Now, stop. Jesus did all those miracles. Jesus did all that compassion, did all that teaching, suffered all that agony, died, rose again. And we say that was a huge amount. But when you think about all the people in the world, how many people actually came to Jesus? When he came here and preached, at first everybody was interested. Everybody loved what he had to say, especially when he gave them free food. But after a while, Jesus said some hard things and people went away from him. After he died and resurrected, you'd think, oh, the world would recognize what he did and just flock to him. But most people do not want him. And this is what he says. I have labored in vain. I have spent my strength for nothing and in vain. Daniel Buntrager, one of our ministers, is sitting in the audience in the class. And I said, Daniel, did you ever feel that way? He says, I have often felt that way. But the fact is, Jesus felt also at the end of verse 4, yet surely my just reward is with the Lord and my work is with my God, who for the joy that was set before him, he knew that there would be a reward for this. He humbled himself and came down into the world and suffered all those indignities because he knew that later on it would be glorious. But while he was here, it was very, very lonely for him. Now, when we read John 13, we don't think about that. But it says it right here. So that's one thing I just recently learned. Okay, now you folks have noticed that there's something on the screen up here. How many of you are upset with that? None of you are upset with this? Well, then I better stop so you can look at that. If you're not upset with that, there's something wrong with you. That's just not up there for a decoration. As soon as you get upset, raise your hands. Okay, I got one hand, two, three, Only three people who are upset with this. Okay, maybe I should use another word. How many of you are bothered by this? Okay, now we got another one. There's a problem up here. How many of you at least see the problem? Now we got some more hands. If you see the problem, it ought to upset you. You see it now? Good. Now remember, we live in a real world, not a dream world. This is a dream world. It's not a real world. It looks like a real world, doesn't it? But it's a dream world. It's not real. Who can tell us why? And this ought to upset you. I hope you live in reality, not in the dream world. What's upsetting about this picture? Yes. Water's not flowing the right way. According to the picture here, the water is going this way, right? Right? Are you saying that the water is flowing uphill? Is it? Or is that flat? It's a bother. It upsets a person. Okay, I don't want to spend too much time on it. Last evening, we spent most of our time talking about what the natural creation tells us about God. And this picture I just had up here was not telling you the truth. In the natural creation, it was lying to you. And that should upset you. If anybody can lie to you and you can just smile about it and say, that's fine, there's something wrong with you or me. It's impossible for God to lie. God could not make something like that in nature, according to the laws that he has made. So last night we were talking about the natural creation and what it tells us about God. Tonight we want to think about what the special revelation he has tells us about himself. Okay? And then later on, I'm going to have to tell you some things that are not so nice. I'm warning you up front. I have some ugly things to share with you. I'll see what we can do about ending on a positive note. But I'm going to tell you also about tomorrow night. We live in a fallen world. My daughter is in a hospital right this moment, having work done on her heart. And by the way, they were able to save her mitral valve. I guess that means they scraped the infection off, but they were able to save it. So that's good news. A fallen world that affects the natural world, it affects the spiritual world. In the natural world, dead fish float downstream. It takes a living fish to swim upstream. The same thing is true in a spiritual world. Dead fish float downstream. It takes living fish to swim upstream spiritually. And I have to share some things with you tomorrow night. It's entitled The Consequences of an Inadequate View of God. What I'm going to share with you tomorrow night, I run a risk. I mean, I'm sure these two gentlemen right here in the front seat beside Norman are not going to understand what I'm going to share. What I'm going to share with you tomorrow night is so well done, there's not a single one of you in here who can understand everything with one sight of what I'm going to show you. You need to see it twice, three times, four times, five times, six times, and you keep seeing more and more of what's there. It's that well done. But it's not a nice picture. So we'll just leave that. So we have both positives and negatives tonight and tomorrow night. In this little book here, The Knowledge of the Holy, A.W. Tozer says some rather profound things. Let me put this on. Ideas have consequences. He says, what comes into our minds when we think about God is the most important thing about us. Now, there might be 70 people sitting here tonight. Do you know there are 70 different concepts of God sitting here tonight? There is not one of us here who understands the God who is in his entirety. Not a one of us. The burden of what I have to share is that I hope that by the end of this week, our hearts can be nudged a little bit closer to reality. We believe a few less lies about God, the God who is true. Because some of us, probably all of us, believe some things that are not true about God. God has hidden himself and yet has revealed himself at the very same time. He shows himself through the natural world. We looked at that last night, and we're going to look at how he shows himself in the spiritual world by his special revelation. That we, in our humanity, have a difficult time deciphering all that, understanding all that, and putting the pieces of puzzle together to get an accurate concept of God. Furthermore, Tozer says, the history of mankind will probably show that no people has ever risen above its religion, and man's spiritual history will positively demonstrate that no religion has ever been greater than its idea of God. Worship is pure or base as the worshiper entertains high or low thoughts of God. That's why I'm sharing this week on this subject. Some people think that when they come together and they get the feeling warm and fuzzy inside, or if they get shouting happy, that they must have gotten close to God. It's a lie. You might feel warm and fuzzy. You might feel shouting happy, but you might not when you get close to God. You might be terrified when you get close to God. You might be humbled when you get close to God. But just because you have an experience like that, that does not say absolutely that you got close to God or you are in His presence. Worship is pure or base as the worshiper entertains high or low thoughts of God. High thoughts of God are accurate thoughts of God. Low thoughts of God are thoughts of Him that are not worthy. And one night this week, we're going to talk about inadequate gods. And they all come from this little book here, Your God is Too Small. We'll save that for another night. For this reason, the greatest question before the church is always God Himself. And the most portentous fact about any man is not what he at any given time may say or do, but what he in his deep heart conceives God to be like. That's why this subject is extremely important. We tend, by a secret law of the soul, to move toward our mental image of God. Let me just pause and show you this. There's really only two gods, only two. There are lots and lots of idols in the world. There's only really two gods. One of them is Jehovah God, and the other one is ourselves. People either worship God or themselves. Now let's look at this self-god. A soul that never discovers God goes around and around itself. Circles itself around and around, increasingly disillusioned, sometimes committing suicide, but always ending up in itself. Starts with itself, ends with itself, just a life of selfishness from start to finish. So depressing that some people just say, this is totally meaningless, and commit suicide. Other people who don't commit suicide live to the end, somehow manage it. Look at this. Some souls go wandering through life, and they live out their existence in the world, but when they do that, they are living for themselves in the world. But that's not what God intended. When He created us, He intended our souls to migrate toward Himself. That's why He shows Himself in two books, the natural book and the special revelation book, because He created us. He wants us to have fellowship with Him. I sat at Henry's table tonight, and I know Henry a little bit, and I know Henry has been given a commission by God to take care of his wife, and he has three sons. Okay? And I don't know what all else Henry is responsible for. That's the very visible part of Henry's responsibilities. He's been given a trust with those people, and his trust, God has given him those four souls, and he is supposed to shepherd them toward God and do everything he can. to make God clear to them so that they choose on their own volition to migrate here. Henry's job is to help his sons learn to love God, because we always go toward what we love. Violet, do you like snakes? Do you migrate towards snakes? I don't think so. You probably do. If anything, you go, wait, you see a snake here, you go this way, right? Yeah. Okay. When we understand that there's nothing here but deadliness, we do not want to circle ourselves and end up in meaninglessness. We have to say, there must be something better than all this. And our brother in our devotionals showed us what it is. When we learn to serve other people. When Jesus came down from heaven, isn't that what he came to do? To serve other people. And he says, I delight to do thy will, O God. And whenever we learn how to serve other people, we delight, we love to do that. We don't have to do that. We get a chance to do that. There's Dee back there. Out of all the ladies in the whole wide world, he looked over and he saw whatever her first name is. What's your wife's first name, Dean?
April.
And he's saying, I wonder which woman in the world will let me take care of her. And I don't know the story, but evidently he approached her and her father, and they both trusted him, and she got into his boat, and he's going to take care of her. He's promised to take care of her. Now, Dean, did you know that you didn't marry a fairy? You didn't marry a fairy. April's not a fairy. She has warts. Did you know that? Okay, but you promised to take care of her, warts and all. We live in a fallen world. And servanthood gets gritty and messy sometimes. And sometimes it's not so nice. I'm seeing that Brother Norman, since I'm here the last time, was not helping his wife open the door and walk in. Last time. This time, he's fulfilling the promise he made to his wife how many ever years ago it was, that you're going to love, cherish, and take care of this woman for the rest of her days, through health, sickness, prosperity, and adversity. And I saw you keeping that promise tonight. When we love the things that we can serve, our happiness grows and grows and grows, and there's no limit. And that's why Jesus, who for the joy that was set before him, came down into the world and gave himself to other people. And now he's exalted at the right hand of God. And he's inviting every one of us as his children, his sons, to be just like that, to find something to serve. Our friend Dean got a chance to serve April. I hope God blesses them with children. And then they're going to have all kinds of opportunities to serve. And when the babies cry in the middle of the night, I remember my wife saying, she's so tired, she says, could you get up and get the baby, please? That's when you don't feel like doing it. You just do what needs to be done. And am I ever glad that I got out of bed every single time when I didn't feel like it? Because now my babies are gone. I don't have a chance to do that anymore. I wish I'd have served my wife better and my children. That is where meaning in life and fulfillment comes from. Jesus knew it. He's teaching us to do it. Okay? This thing about moving toward our mental image of God. He says this is true not only of the individual Christian, but of the company of Christian that composes the church. Always, the most revealing thing about the church is her idea of God. Just as her most significant message is what she says about him or leaves unsaid. For her silence is often more eloquent than her speech. And I'm a conservative Mennonite, and I don't know, I've never gone to church here long term. I don't know what all you say about God, but I do know in conservative Mennonite circles, we have not adequately represented God like we should have. She could never escape the self-disclosure of her witness concerning God. I'm hoping you folks at Calvary nurture the concept of Jesus for who he really is, the express image of God. Let me just pause to say this. When God put Adam and Eve in the world, and whenever they sinned, he set about a program to get these people back to himself because he wants to fellowship with them. That's why he made Henry. That's why he made his wife. That's why he made those children, those sons of his. Every person who is born, God gave them a soul because he wants that soul to come back to him. He wants to fellowship with him. I think God must look forward to Sunday every week when the nations around the world, whoever knows him, stops their work and thinks about him, fellowships with him. I was sitting at breakfast table this morning here with Brother Simon. And he says, he and his wife, first thing they do when they roll out of bed in the morning is kneel beside their beds and pray. And the last thing they do before they crawl in at bed at night is they pray. I think God enjoys getting Simon getting up, and I think God enjoys Simon going to bed because he gets a chance to hear from him. Now, you all know that prayer is not just talking to God. Sometimes prayer is just there. You're just there to hear what God says. We distill our hearts and hear and listen what God is saying. Tozer further says, were we able to extract from any man a complete answer to the question, what comes into your mind when you think about God, we might predict with certainty, get that, the certainty, the spiritual future of that man. This underscores why this subject is so important. A person who has an accurate concept of God, everything's okay. Everything's okay. People go astray when they don't know the God who is, or they choose to reject the God who is. But the job of a parent and the job of a church is to take all those little boys and girls that come into the world and show them the God who is and help them understand it's your best interest as well as the glory of God when you go toward him and when you serve other people. The worst thing you can do for yourself is to be selfish. You will destroy yourself. You will destroy your future. You will not have a happy family. You're going to have all kinds of stress and struggles in life because of that. Can you imagine what kind of marriage two selfish people have? Can you imagine the struggles the little children live with every day with two parents who scrap with each other when there's no love? Do you know that the world is full of people like that? And God's heart must cry. He doesn't want people to be that way. He's given all kinds of... He's come into the world and talked to us through the natural creation, through his book. And yet people refuse both of those and they want to do their own thing. They think they know better than God. And he eventually says, God says, I'm a gentleman. I will not force anybody to do anything. You're allowed to do it your way, but I choose the consequences. With me, everything is okay. If you come to me, I will not cast you out. It will be well forever. But if you want to do your own thing, then you're going to have to live with the consequences. The absence of God is the worst thing that can ever happen to me. If God would withdraw himself and I would be a lonely soul without him, that would be the worst thing. That's even worse than dying. Were we able to know exactly what our most influential religious leaders think of God today, we might be able, with some precision, to foretell where the church will stand tomorrow. Without doubt, the mightiest thought the mind can entertain is the thought of God. And the weightiest word in any language is its word for God. Thought and speech are God's gifts to creatures made in his image. These are intimately associated with him and impossible apart from him. It is highly significant that the first word was the Word. And the Word was with God, and the Word was God. We may speak because God spoke. In him, word and idea are invisible. That our idea of God correspond as nearly as possible to the true being of God is of immense importance to us. And if you want to read the rest of it, get this book. I read straight out of this book. All right, let's quickly review a few things from last night. Maybe the first thing we'll do, review, is I want you to imagine a dark room. That yourself is in a dark room. There's no windows, no doors. It's completely dark. And then you notice that a certain place somewhere in this room, you see a little beam of light. Now, if it's totally dark, you're going to gravitate toward that light. You want to see what that light is. If it's just a little beam of light, you're going to come over, and if you can, you're going to put your eye up to the hole. And I'd like to, there's a piece of cardboard. You see that little hole right there? Okay, on my side of this cardboard, it says beauty, truth, and goodness. The things we talked about last night. Okay, I'm looking through this at a distance right here, and I can see something blue on the other side. I think it might be Simon's shirt. I can't see. What else is there? That's all I can see. I can see a blue and maybe a black button or something. No, it's a suspender. Shadow of a suspender. That's all I can see. Now watch what happens here. If I'm in this dark room and the light is coming through and I love what I like light, and so I bring my eye up to this hole. The closer I get to this hole, the more I can see. And lo and behold, I can see a beautiful old man sitting there. And I can see more than just Simon, too. Truth, beauty, and goodness. The closer we get to the aperture, the more beauty we can see on the other side. Now, this is a call from God. The truth, beauty, and goodness in the world is God's call to us. Look through that. I have some wonderful things to show you. And we get a chance every day to do that. And coming down here and being a part of your world, I get a chance to see truth, beauty, and goodness down here in this neck of the woods. The more we see, the more our desire grows for the source of truth, beauty, and goodness. You see, God doesn't want us to stop just with the truth, beauty, and goodness that we see. We want to see him as the source of this. And we say, I want that person, God or Jesus, I want that person in here, in my life. Eventually, truth, beauty, and goodness will lead us to focus on a person, Jesus Christ. And we discover, when we see him as the source of everything beautiful, everything good, and everything that's true, we will say, we must have him. I must have him. And that's exactly what that book out there and this book in here leads us to. To say, we must have him. I will die if I don't get him. I will do whatever it takes to get him in my heart. And then we go there. and we partake of him, and we discover it was better than we even thought it was. Our souls are deeply satisfied, and we don't have any questions. We don't want the world and our selfish flesh anymore, because Jesus says, I delight to do thy will, O God. And we become a son of God, we say the same thing. I delight to do your will, O God. Show me more of what you want me to do so I can do it. Now we have struggles, but he's there. I just learned something else. I shared something very deep from Isaiah, and my daughter was going into surgery this morning. So I read her this verse. She said, thank you, Father. It was a privilege to share that with her. Let's move on. Last night, we looked at the evidence of God in the natural world, mathematics. I didn't even say very much. But let me say one little tiny thing about mathematics. Maybe two. If you take the circumference of a circle and divide it by its diameter, what do you get? Someone tell me. It's not a trick question. It's a math question. Circumference and divided by its diameter. What do you get? Y'all don't go to school down here? That's not a hard question. Pi, thank you. Do you know that pi is a number that you can't really comprehend? If you took one-third, the fraction one-third, and divide 1 by 3, what do you get as a decimal? Pretty easy. Just say it, somebody. 1 divided by 3, what do you get? Pardon? That's right. 3 repeating 3. How long does it go? Forever. Okay? If you take 1 and divide it by 8, what do you get? Suppose memorize this. It's math books I use, say you got to memorize this. I tell my students you got to know this until you're 80. Okay? So 1 divided by 8 is what? Decimal. Okay? Yeah. 0.125, which is 125,000. Okay? Does that keep repeating? Yes or no? Not a trick question. Does it? 1 divided by 8. 0.125. Is that it? Or does it repeat? Pardon? That's it. It just stops right there. It's a terminating decimal compared to one it keeps repeating. Okay, when you go to the word, the number pi, it is non-terminating and it's non-repeating. It just goes 3.1416 blah, 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 forever. It's a very amazing number. It's called pi. Mathematics is so important for the study of physics that you've got to have, you can't study physics without math. And if you want to send a rocket ship to the moon, you've got to have some math. They know God's laws are so precise that all you got to know is certain laws, and then you shoot your rockets off with certain amounts of propulsion to go so high and so fast that you get into orbit. And you can go into a low orbit where you got to go faster, or you go a higher orbit where you go not quite as fast, and so on. And they have this thing down to a science. Right now, you all have GPS around here, I suppose, don't you? Okay? Do you know that they have put a satellite in orbit up above here? The Earth is spinning from east to west. Sorry, west to east, right? Spinning. Is this east over here? Okay, the Earth is spinning that way, right? Okay? It's going about 1,000 miles an hour at the equator. They want to position a satellite so it stays above, we'll say straight above Paris. Stays there positively in the sky so it can keep beaming down here all the time. Well, they put that satellite up at a certain distance, at a certain speed, so it doesn't vary. And as the Earth spins, it spins too. All on mathematics. God's laws are so dependable on centrifugal and centripetal force. You put those two together, it's just perfect. And we could go on and on and on about mathematics. Okay, so that's in the natural world. We talked about science yesterday, also in the natural world, with the systems and processes. Conscience, people, all around the world, everybody knows that you don't kill people. You don't commit adultery. You don't take other people's wives. And you don't steal. And you don't tell lies. It's universal. God has put that in the consciences of people at birth. We think in terms of a 7-day week. This happens to be, this is Wednesday night. Yeah, this is Wednesday. Do you know, why do we have 7 days in our week? Why don't we have 8 or 6? Who can tell me? It's not a hard question. Good try. I think there's another reason. God made what in 7 days? He made 6 days and he rested on the 7th day. Okay. So, did the Buddhists believe that? Did the Hindus believe that? Do they have a 7-day week? Does Japan operate on 7-day week? Does Russia? Does China? Or do they have different days in their weeks? Any of you travel over China, Thailand? They all have 7 days. Where's that come from? It's a tradition. It's a Judeo-Christian tradition that is spread all around the world. There's no reason for Buddhists to do that. There's no reason for Hindus to do that. There's no reason for Shintos to do that. But they kind of match with the tradition of the West, with the Judeo-Christian. Now, Muslims also have the same kind of roots we do, so they can fit this thing. It's a tradition. You know, the French are kind of have been a reputation of being arrogant. One day they decided, you know, we invented the decimal system. It's a wonderful system based on everything in 10. You know, the metric system is a whole lot easier to learn than the English system. Well, if you go to school, you learn that. So these French people said, you know what? Why don't we make a 10-day week too? Change the tradition to make it 10 days. We'll work 9 days and rest one. So they tried it. Didn't work. They brought themselves back. And I don't know if it was a communist country or whatever. I don't know the source of this one. But somebody decided we're going to try, instead of 7 days, let's have a weekend more often. So we're going to have a week of 5 days. Well, that didn't work either. So as far as I know, the whole world's on 7 days. Traditions exist because people have discovered that what is there has some kind of value. It's a long-standing value. And you just don't go throwing traditions away. Because if you do, you're going to get in trouble, like the people who change the number of days in a week. We could talk about that for a while. We looked at the triunity in nature last night. Okay, so you have all this evidence for God out there, plus what we're going to share here shortly. Do you have everybody saying, oh, yes, wow, there must be a God. I'm convinced. Is that the way it works? Talk to me. Is everybody just so thoroughly convinced out there that there's a God? That everybody's a believer in God? Is that the way it works? No! What does it take then? The sun comes up every day at my place, and the grass and the corn is growing at my place too. Everything's working in the world. I think the earth's still spinning. Everything's still working. But some people can't see it. They don't see God there. When the Russians put their first cosmonaut up, he looked out his window and he looked around and he radioed down to the ground and he says, I don't see God anywhere up here. That was supposed to be a plug for atheism. God must not exist because I can't see. Later on when the U.S. put their astronauts up, I think it was either John Glenn or whatever, says, you know, I see God up here. What's the difference? Pardon?
Speaking about God, it's there because he saw it. Blessedness is what it was there.
Why couldn't the Russians see it?
His
belief system. He didn't want to. That's right. So God gives all this evidence, but he stands back again as a gentleman said, look, here it is. Dean, did you approach April and say, go right now, get in my car. You are going to be mine. Did you do that? Did you have to convince her to get in your boat? Didn't take much convincing? Well, you're a kind of fortunate man. Now, some people, it takes a lot of convincing. There are all kinds of stories that could be told on that one. Okay. Well, God is the one that has to convince us. And now, every one of us has a story on this one. I don't know how much wooing he had to do for you. I know his story with me. How much wooing he had to do for me. But God is so much of a gentleman. He does not force anybody into his camp. He woos and calls people. And people say, evidently April said yes to Dean over there, and that must have been pretty easy. But sometimes they say no. That's another story. We won't go there. Okay, now tonight, before we run out of time here, we're going to look at some evidence of God, for God, from the Bible, special revelation. There's some evidence for God in churches, and I'm not going to go there tonight. That is a whole subject in itself. Evidence for God in personal testimonies is limited. We were doing some street work in Austin one time, and my son was visiting with an atheist, and my son told this atheist was wondering, how do you know there's a God? And my son says, well, I have peace and joy. And the atheist says, well, I have peace and joy too. Peace and joy is a very subjective thing. It's not objective. Emotions are subjective. They're not objective. So it looks to me, I've been in Simon's home 3 years ago, and now I'm at Simon's home again. I could see that the man knows God. I could see that, okay? But some atheists could protest that. So that's just Simon's tradition. We're not going to go there. What I'm trying to get at is, this is not a real strong evidence for God. Now, I myself have had enough personal experiences with God. He has done some things, some real special things for me. If I would ever turn my back on God, I don't know what in the world God is ever going to say to me in terms of what he's done for me already. You mean I did this, and I did this, this, and this, and you're going to pretend that that didn't happen? These are very precious to me. So precious and sacred, I don't always share. And I could share with you personally if you wonder. But evidence is never strong enough again to compel people to believe when they refuse to. I can give the best testimony. We can have the evidence here, and we can have the evidence in the Bible, and some people will still refuse God. Why? Because they want themselves. Here's what has to happen. The primary light source. Now this is both sun and sun. Natural, spiritual. If this is me, that light, natural and spiritual, needs to be primary. It needs to be from the source, from God to me. Now I can look at Simon, and I can look at Norman, I can look at you others, and I can see what God has done to you, but it's like the moon. I can see the moon, but the moon does not give light that's bright like the sun. It's secondary. Light goes here and bounces off and then comes to the earth. You cannot be a Christian and have a moon experience. You are only a child of God if you have a primary experience with the light, with natural and spiritual, especially the spiritual. That's very profound. In order to worship God, we must be impressed by the size and the unlimited power of God. That's intellectual. We must be moved with genuine admiration, respect, and affection for God. That's emotional. Notice it says genuine. Nothing fake, nothing put on, but genuine. And we must be impressed with our own smallness and neediness. And Jesus says, when he was here, he says, I didn't come to save the righteous. I come for the sick, the needy people. I hope this church is known as the Calvary Hospital. I hope this is not the Calvary Museum. Museums are full of dead things that they show visitors. That's not a church. Jesus only comes for people who realize how needy they are. And he comes and is there for them. He is the healer of sicknesses, spiritual, emotional, and physical. And so who is Jesus Christ? He is a historical figure. In other words, he did come here in a physical body, lived in a certain place at a certain time. And when he was here, he was a philosopher. He was a teacher. And there are things he asks us to believe about him. Creedal. Creedal has to do with statements of belief. He was a great ethical example. Our brother Norman just showed us tonight. He didn't say, okay, you folks, you ought to wash feet. He got down and showed us how. He was a compassionate healer. He was a savior. By his atoning work. And Lord, he rose from the dead. But he has to be more than this. For each of us, he needs to be a present, living being. Dwelling inside us. If number 7 is not true, then you and I are not a Christian. I don't care what we say. The rest of the 6 doesn't count. Are they important? Yes, every one of them is. They come before number 7. But we are a child of God. Whenever Jesus Christ is more than these, he is a present living being that dwells inside us. He wants to showcase himself to the world. And I was over at Yoder Brothers today, and I found out that James and his wife were going to showcase Christ to some state officials of Tennessee today. Bless you, James. I would wonder what those men thought, these ladies thought. You know, one of the things nice about living out here compared to northern Indiana, at least in Texas, all you need to do to preach a sermon is to take your wife and children and go to Walmart. That's all. People see that and they go, where did that come from? What's that? I could talk for a while about that, better not. Jesus Christ is the truest, most attractive, most useful, most humble, purest person of his time. And yet he was rejected, despised, and killed by those who were blinded by their own agendas. Can you and I expect anything different? And the answer is no. If you are rejected, ridiculed, or whatever, because of your simple faith in Christ, then Jesus says, you are blessed. Blessed are they which are persecuted for righteousness' sake. For great is your... For theirs is the kingdom of heaven, I think it says. Blessed are those who persecute you for righteousness' sake, for theirs is the kingdom of heaven. Wow. Okay, I'm going to leave the rest of these for another time. I'll do one more, and then I want to... By this time, you already know my weakness is I get to talking about things, and I talk too much. So you're allowed to tell me, all right, Chester, that's enough. Go on, okay? Here's what I was talking to you about last night, the yin-yang thing. This is exactly what Satan wants us to think about, evil and good. If this is evil and this is good, he wants us to think that they are equal and they're forever spinning in relation to each other. One is equal to the other. That is absolutely false, but he wants us to think this way. And when you have to deal with evil in your life and the evil in the world and all, remember, it seems like sometimes that the evil is stronger than the good. That's a lie. The good is always stronger than the evil. Always. Always, always. But God is a gentleman. He stands back. And if people want to do evil, he lets them do it. But eventually, he has the last word. Okay. Now to conclude this. I would like now to spend some time to see what the Scripture has to say about itself on this subject. And I'm going to just read some things, and then you can just listen if you want to, and I'm not going to comment much. This is what the Bible has to say about God. And I'm only reading a few. Listen to this. And now Moses was tending the flock of Jethro, his father-in-law, the priest of Midian. He led his flock to the back of the desert, came to the Horeb, the mountain of God. And the angel of the Lord appeared to him in the flame of fire in the midst of a bush. So he looked, and behold, a bush was burning with fire, but the bush was not consumed. Then Moses said, I will now turn aside and see this great sight. Why the bush does not burn? And when the Lord saw that he turned aside to look, God called to him from the midst of the bush and said, Moses! Moses! And he said, here am I. He said, do not draw near this place. Take your sandals off your feet, for the place where you stand is holy ground. Moreover, he said, I am the God of your father. Tradition, the God of Abraham, the God of Isaac, and the God of Jacob. And Moses hid his face, for he was afraid to look upon God. We could go on quite at length there. Let me go down and skip a couple verses and read this. Then Moses said to God, "Indeed, when I come to the children of Israel and say to them, 'The God of your fathers, the God of your tradition, has sent me to you,' they will say to me, 'What is his name? What shall I say to them?'" And God said to Moses, "I am who I am." And he said, "Thus you shall say to the children of Israel, 'I am has sent me to you.'" And he goes on. I won't read the rest of that. "In the year that King Uzziah died, I saw the Lord sitting on a throne high and lifted up, and his train filled the temple. The train of his robe filled the temple. Above it stood seraphim. Each one had six wings. With two he covered his face, with two he covered his feet, and with two he flew. And one cried to another and said, 'Holy, holy, holy is the Lord of hosts. The whole earth is full of his glory.' And the posts of the door were shaken," or we could say were vibrating, "by the voice of him who cried out, and the house was filled with smoke." Now, if that would happen here tonight, what would we do? We get scared. "So I said, 'Woe's me, for I am undone, because I am a man of unclean lips, and I dwell in the midst of people of unclean lips, for mine eyes have seen the King, the Lord of hosts.' Then one of the seraphim flew to me, having a hand, a live coal, which he had taken with the tongs from the altar, and he touched my mouth with it and said, 'Behold, this has touched your lips. Your iniquity is taken away, and your sin is purged.' And I heard the voice of the Lord saying, 'Whom shall I send, and who will go for us?' And I said, 'Here am I, send me.' And he said, 'Go and tell this people,' but they won't listen to you." That's in my words, the rest of it. I won't read the rest of it there. And the Lord said to Moses, "Behold, I come to you in a thick cloud, and that the people may hear when I speak with you and believe you forever." So Moses told the words of the people to the Lord. Then the Lord said to Moses, "Go to the people and consecrate them today and tomorrow, and let them wash their clothes, and let them be ready for the third day. For on the third day, the Lord will come down upon Mount Sinai in the sight of all the people. And you shall set bounds for the people all around, saying, 'Take heed to yourselves that you do not go up to the mountain or touch its base. Whoever touches the mountain shall surely be put to death. No hand shall touch him, but he shall surely be stoned or shot with an arrow. Whether man or beast, he shall not live. When the trumpet sounds long, they shall come near the mountain.'" By the way, if you read the book of the Exodus case, that pile of stones is still there to this day, and you can go see it. The boundary that they could not come any closer. So Moses went down from the mountain to the people and sanctified the people, and they washed their clothes. He said to the people, "Be ready for the third day. Do not come near your wives." Then it came to pass on the third day in the morning that there were thunderings and lightnings and a thick cloud on the mountain, and the sound of the trumpet was very loud, so that all the people in the camp trembled. And Moses brought the people out of the camp to meet with God, and they stood at the foot of the mountain. Now Mount Sinai was completely in smoke because the Lord descended upon it in fire. Its smoke ascended like the smoke of a furnace, and the whole mountain quaked greatly. And when the blast of the trumpet sounded long and became louder and louder, Moses spoke, and God answered him by a voice. I wonder what that sounded like. Then the Lord came down upon Mount Sinai on the top of the mountain. And the Lord called Moses to the top of the mountain, and Moses went up, and the Lord said to Moses, and we'll just stop reading there. How would you have felt that day? That would have been so impressive. And we could go on. Do you know that one time God came down and met Moses in the tabernacle, and from there on there was a pillar of fire by day, and by night it was a pillar of cloud. It was lit up. And it was a miracle every day for the Israelites to see with their eyes. And it was another miracle every day when people could go out there and pick up that manna and they could eat, a miracle from God. And God gave them water in the desert. And God made their shoes so they didn't wear out. A miracle that happened every day. And so, with all those miracles every day, did everybody believe? Was everybody faithful? No. There were unbelievers. And that most of that generation had to die because they did not receive the word of God. Two men did, Joshua and Caleb. Listen to this. That's Old Testament. This is New Testament. Jesus said to him, I am the way, the truth, and the life. No one comes to the Father except through me. That's quite a statement. If you had known me, you would have known my Father. It says in Hebrews that Jesus was the express image of God's person. The nature out there shows us some things about God. We can read things in here about God. I just read to you about some of the manifestations of God. But if you really want to know what God is like, you look at Jesus. He said, if you would have known me, you would have known my Father also. And from now on, you know him and have seen him. Philip said to him, Lord, show us the Father, and it's sufficient for us. And I guess Jesus got a little upset. Philip, what are you saying? What did I just say? I've been with you all this time, and yet you don't know me yet? He has seen me, has seen the Father. How can you say, show us the Father? Do you not believe that I am in the Father and the Father in me? The words that I speak to you, I don't speak of my own authority, but the Father who dwells in me does the works. Believe me that I am in the Father and the Father in me, or else believe me for the sake of the works themselves. And we could go on. Okay, we could read these words of Jesus, and they can be intellectual. We can even be moved emotionally by some of the things that Jesus says and does. But once again, we do not know him until he is a living presence in our lives every day. Then we know God. Until then, we really don't know God. And so, in our hearts, our burning hearts, every day, we should say to Jesus, to God, show us the Father. And the Father will say, look at my book out there. Look at this book here. And most of all, look at Jesus and listen to what he says. And whenever he speaks to you, say, like Saul said, who are you, Lord? Tell me what you want me to do. And he will give us work to do, because there's so much work in the world. It's waiting to be done. Let's kneel as we pray.